Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
With all the discussion today in the convention over ordaining women, preachers, or deacons, we've got the only woman who ever reigned in Judah or Israel, Athaliah. Boy, was she a doozy, I want you to know. And we're going to be dealing her in 2 Kings chapter 11. She is the daughter of Jezebel and is going to act just like her. Woo! But before I get to that, I'm really excited about this thing that I have offered you, that I have sent to you, this outline. This is going to be the most helpful thing. We're going to try to get a little bit closer shot. You should have a copy of this. This is an outline of all the major events, of all the major dates, of the prophets, where they fit and whose reign and what's life, the enemies that Israel had at every period. On the back is post-exilic prophets. I think this is going to be really helpful to you. Now, this is a combination of a 60-foot chart that I did on butcher paper. And so it's a little confusing. You're going to take a minute to have to look at it. The first page has, the top is one part of the outline. The second part's the continuation of the dateline. The back is the third part. So only I could get it on legal-sized paper for you. I think it's really going to clear up a lot of the uncertainty about all these kings, because there's one man in Judah by one name, the same guy in Israel, and they're flipping and flopping, and it's just hard to follow. This will help. Now, to study 2 Kings 11, you must read 2 Chronicles 23. The fuller account is 2 Chronicles 23, or at least it adds some details that the writer of Kings doesn't add. So you need to really read 2 Chronicles 23. And let's think together. In chapter 9, we were in Israel. But in chapter 11, we're in Judah. And that's what's so difficult. You've got to keep in mind, the author is flip-flopping from Israel to Judah. And so chapter 11 is Judah, all right? Now, we're really picking up on what happened after the king was killed, Ahijah. And you look at that in verse 1, chapter 11, verse 1. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahijah, saw that her son was dead. Now, if you go back to chapter 9, verse 27 and 28, that's what we're talking about. Now, Athaliah was Ahab's and Jezebel's daughter. Now, her name means Yahweh is exalted. Now, isn't that strange? It seems that Ahab, if you've read much about his life, still had a peripheral commitment to Yahwehism, even though Jezebel was pushing Baalism. So he named one of his daughters after the covenant name for God. Her name may have been Yahwistic, but her attitude was Jezebel, I want you to know. And so she's the mother, and her son was king. Saw that her son was dead. She arose and destroyed all the royal offspring. My goodness, this lady killed all of her relatives. Now, the reason she did that is these were all of the descendants of David that she's trying to wipe out. She knows she's going to lose her place of power. She's not going to be queen mother. And it's either act now decisively or just leave power. Boy, she acts decisively. Now, there wasn't a whole lot of David's descendants left, because Jehoram, who was her husband, had killed many of his own brothers already. Look at 2 Chronicles 21, 1 through 4. He had all his brothers killed when he ascended the throne. Now, the other thing is, a lot of these Davidic descendants were killed by an Arab raid that God engineered in 2 Chronicles 21, 16 and 17. So there were not many descendants of David left around. But all that there were, Athaliah went after. And she wanted them dead. Now, Jehosheba, and the name in Chronicles is Jehoshabath, but anyway, Jehosheba, now she is Josiah's, that's going to be the king, that's going to be a little boy, 1 year old, Joash. She's going to take Joash and hide him. Now she is Joash's aunt, okay? She was Jehoram's sister. That sound confusing? Well, it's like a family tree, doesn't it? That's exactly what it is. She is also, if you'll look down in verse 4, we have the really important figure in this chapter is not the little king, Joash, but Jehoiada the priest. And she is Jehoiada's wife. It's kind of like you're watching as the world turns, isn't it, with all this family intrigue going on here, okay? This lady took the youngest son and hit him. Now, look where she hit him. Notice down in the middle of verse 2, and his nurse took his nurse and him, and that was, of course, his source of nourishment, and put him in the bedroom. Now, ancients let their children nurse much longer than moderns do, sometimes up to 2.5, 3, 3.5 years. So they had to have a wet nurse. That's where this woman was. She was very necessary. And it says, in the bedroom. Now, when I think that, I'd think they must have hit him under the bed. But this is the special chamber in Oriental palaces where all the bed linen was stored, like the winter bed linen was stored and the summer bed linen and extra bed linen for guests. So it was like a huge room full of mattresses. Well, that's where this young one-year-old boy was initially hidden from Athaliah's wrath. And it wasn't really wrath. It was just her intrigue and wanting to stay in power. Okay? So he was hid with her in the house of the Lord 6 years. Now, her husband was the high priest. So it's pretty easy at some point during this time to get the boy out of the linen closet and into the temple. Now, the temple had many, many rooms where people could live. Matter of fact, I've got a slide of the temple that I want to show you. We're going to put it up, and I want to talk to you about it if I could, okay? Now, this is a modern rendition of what we think Solomon's temple looked like, and that's what we're talking about. You see that structure there? Those two pillars are mentioned in the Bible by name, and you walk into the Holy of Holies. But inside that building, there was apparently many rooms for the priest to live. And along that wall were porches where people could live. And that apparently is where that boy was hid for all of those years, somewhere in that temple complex. And it was very sacred. Some of those rooms, nobody could go in but the priest. And that's how they hid this young royal heir of the Davidic throne. Now, while Athaliah was reigning over the land. Now, I want you to think about this. Here is this woman. Her son is killed, so she kills everybody else. She is a daughter to Jezebel. It was probably her ideal to get Jehoram to kill all his brothers anyway. Now she's just exterminated the rest of them. And here is a foreign woman on the throne of Judah right next to the temple. And she is importing the worship of Baal Melquot, the Tyranian fertility god. It goes so far that over in chapter 11, a little bit later in verse 18, they even built a temple to Baal in or near Jerusalem. They even set up a priesthood, and there was a high priest of Baal, just like there was a high priest of Yahweh. Friends, you can't imagine how bad the amalgamation and eclectic approach to religion was in the 6 years that Athaliah reigned in Judah. Now, it seems like she's never mentioned the reign of kings in other parts. No one ever considered that she was actually a true monarch. But friends, she reigned over Judah 6 long idolatrous years. Boy. Now, then in verse 4. Now, in the 7th year, Jehoiada, he's the high priest, we learn from verse 9, sent and brought the captains of the 100. Now, look at your Bible in verse 4. Do you have a word there? Mine has the Kerites. Does yours have that, the Kerites? Now, from 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 23, a variant reading has the word Cherethites, Cherethites. Now, these are a foreign group that are often identified with David. Now, another group is the Pelethites, Pelethites. I think the Korites in verse 4 are to be identified with the Cherites of the time of David and Solomon. These were either foreign mercenaries, or some say they were descendants from the island of Crete and from the Philistines. I don't know. The etymology is very ambiguous and very uncertain here. But these were extremely loyal patriots. Friends, if you need to count on somebody when times were hard, you could count on these kind of men. And I think the high priest knew that from history and from personal experience. And he called these men to him. Now, these were the leaders of the different military guards and groups that protected the temple and watched the temple during different parts of the year. He called them together, okay, and brought them into the house of the Lord. Obviously, we're in Jerusalem, and here is the temple, okay? And he made a covenant with them. Now, here is the non-theological use of the term berith, or covenant. And so it shows he made a deal with them, made an agreement with them, had mutual aspects, and put them under an oath in the house of the Lord. They had to swear in God's name that they would not violate this covenant. Now, friends, to the ancients, to call God's name meant to bring God into that agreement. That was a serious thing to them. Okay? And showed them the king's son. Apparently, these men, when they saw there was a divinic ruler left, they were much more ready to follow the high priest's lead. You might want to see 2 Chronicles 23:2, because there's much more people involved than just what seems here. The fuller accounts in 2 Chronicles 23:2, where it says these leaders of hundreds went out into Judah and searched out Levites and priests and told them what was happening and said, now a certain Sabbath, you come to the temple. Now what this high priest is trying to do, without rising any suspicion from anybody, he's going to get the change of guard on a certain Sabbath to stay and the new change of guard to come. And all these priests and Levites from around the country are going to happen to be there on this certain worship day. But it's, and there would be nothing unusual about them being in the temple. And he'll have a large group of people. Some of them are going to be equipped with David's own military implements from the temple. And they're going to be ready to have a coup d'etat on one given Sabbath. And that's what all this is about. Now, and he commanded him, saying, this is the thing that you shall do. One-third of you come in on the Sabbath and keep watch over the king's house. One-third of you shall also be at the gate, sir. Now, we know where this is. In the book of 2 Chronicles, it calls it the gate of the fountain, foundation. I don't know which one it is. We don't know where it is. And one-third at the gate behind the guard shall keep watch over the house for defense. And two-parts of you, even all who go out on the Sabbath, shall keep watch over the house of the Lord for the king. Now, here are all these leaders, and the king, this high priest is saying, now, you're going to be here this certain Saturday, and you're going to be here this certain Saturday, and you're going to be here, and at a certain time, we're all going to come together, and I'm going to stand the king in the midst, we're going to name him king, and you're going to protect him from the crowd and from Athaliah's guards. That's what we're planning. Okay? Verse 9. So the captains of hundreds did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded. Each of them took his men who were to come in the Sabbath and those which were to go out on the Sabbath, and they came to Jehoiada the priest, high priest. And the priest gave to the captains of hundreds spears and shields which had been King David. Now, you know, a lot of movies done recently about King Arthur's sword. There was something about King Arthur's sword that years later, you know, was supposed to have special value. Can you imagine what these men must have thought? Where they were given the very weapons of King David from the temple. Friends, there was a love. There was a promise of God to keep that throne going back in 2 Samuel 7. And here we have, not only have they found out there is a divinic seed still living, there is a divinic king available. 7-year-old though he may be, he's available. Not only that, the high priest is supporting this coup d'etat, and they even have the weapons that King David himself put in the temple. Man, you talk about raising the flag, singing God Bless America. This is patriotic for those Jewish people. And boy, they rally to the support of this young king. And the guards stood, each with his weapons in his hand, on the right side of the house, on the left side of the house, by the altar. Now, the altar here is not the incense altar that's right in front of the veil in the holy place, because no one can go in there but the priest. This is the altar of sacrifice. Now, I want to tell you something to be very good for you to do, is to get a Bible dictionary and on your own, draw in, with your own hand on a blank piece of paper, the outline of the temple, where the Holy of Holies is, where the holy place is, where the laver is, where the altar of sacrifice, where the altar of incense, where the menorah, where the table of showbread is, where the porticoes are, where the gates are. If you ever do that, now don't just look at a picture in a Bible dictionary. Draw it in your own mind from trying to read the biblical material. And you'll probably make a mistake or two, but if you do that with your own hand, you'll never forget it. So we're out in front of the holy place. There, right to the this side would be the large sea, the golden sea, supported on four bullocks, would be the laver. And then right in front of that door of the holy place would be the uplifted altar of sacrifice, where the blood of victims was poured out at its base, and the fat and the entrails was placed on the altar to burn. Now, that's the altar we're talking about. Okay? verse 12. Then he brought the king's son out and put a crown on him. Now, the Hebrew word for crown is etymologically related to the word Nazarite. The word for crown is Nazar. Now, there is a obvious linkage here between dedication to God. So the crown was probably a band of gold, a Nazarite, committed to God, the crown, and gave him the testimony. Now, what is that? Well, either the priest is putting the two stone tablets of the Decalogue that God wrote with his own finger and gave to Moses that was in the Ark of the Covenant. Now, that seems hard for me to believe for two reasons. Number one, I don't think anybody at this stage of the game is going to open the Ark of the Covenant and get those things out. That's become too holy. Even the high priest can only enter once a year on the Day of Atonement. He has to fill the place with smoke with the incense altar and take the blood of bulls and goats for sacrifice. He's not about to open that thing up. He'd be afraid to die. And besides, can you imagine putting two... I'm going to use an analogy, concrete slabs on the lap of a seven-year-old boy? No. I think we have a copy of the Torah. Maybe the full Pentateuch, maybe just the Ten Commandments. I don't know what. But some part of that law at Sinai was given to that king as a symbol that he is Yahweh's representative to fulfill the covenant obligations. And that's the word testimony. Exodus 25:16, Exodus 31:18. And anointed him. Now remember, anointing is the root word of the word Messiah. And it means as a symbol of the unique calling, the unique equipping, and the unique task given by God to prophets, priests, and kings. Now this is where John Calvin got his theological outline for the life of Christ, prophet, priest, and king. He fulfills all those functions which in the Old Testament were the ones anointed. And he is the supreme anointed one, the Messiah. Now, they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king." It's a very common thing. You can follow it in your reference Bible all the way back through Israel and Judah. Then Athaliah heard the noise of the guard and of the people. She came to the people in the house of the Lord. I bet she hadn't been in the Lord's house. This is a fertility worshiper. She had gone to Baal's temple. She didn't go to Yahweh's temple, probably. Now, probably as a strong enough Yahwistic group to keep her in check, she couldn't close that Yahwistic temple down, but she didn't go there. Here we have her rushing in to the temple area, okay, because she heard that noise. She looked, and behold, the king was standing by the pillar. Now, this idea of the king standing by the pillar is one or two things. I have forgotten the name of those pillars. One of them is Bochim and one of them is something else. But they're named on either side. Either the king stood by one of those famous pillars, or the word pillar here means a raised platform in a conspicuous area where the king normally stood on worship days. Now, because of other places like chapter 23, verse 3 of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles 23:13, and especially Nehemiah 8:4, I believe it's an elevated platform especially built for the king so all the people could see that the representative of God was worshiping with the people. And so I think that's what she saw. The king was conspicuous, a seven-year-old boy. I bet she knew she missed one, and she knew right off who it was and what was happening. According to the custom, that means that's where the king usually stood, with the captains and the trumpeters beside the king, and all the people of the land rejoicing, and the trumpets blew, then Athaliah tore her clothes and cried, "Treason, treason." Well, of course, the tearing of the clothes was a sign of mourning, a sign of blasphemy, a sign of horror. I think the girl knew the jig was up, and she cries out, "Treason, treason," hopefully someone will help her, but no one comes to her aid. And Jehoiada the priest commanded the captains of the hundreds who were appointed over the army and said to them, "Bring her out between the ranks." Now, it seems like that they did not want anybody to kill her in the temple. So those soldiers, those leaders, formed two rows on each side of her and walked her out of that temple area and began to walk her toward the palace. Jehoiada wanted her killed, but did not want her killed on the temple area. Okay? So they walked her out, and the priest said, "Let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord." And so they seized her, and when she arrived at the horse's entrance to the king's house, they put her to death there. Pretty low place to die is to die at the palace where the horses come in when you've lived in the palace 6 years. Now, verse 17. Then Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord, the king, and the people, that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people. The concept of bereath is a very important biblical concept. God established a covenant with Abraham, Genesis 12, 15, 22. He continued that covenant through all the patriarchs. It was widened to the 12 tribes of Jacob or Israel. It was still in effect through Saul, David, Solomon, through the split kingdom of Jeroboam, northern 10 tribes, Rehoboam, southern 2 tribes. And now we're coming back to say that that same covenant that God established at Sinai, that had been years before established with Abraham, the covenant conditions were the same, but every generation had to submit themselves individually to the ancient agreement. And I think that's what we have right here, a recommitment to the ancient Yahwistic covenant. 2 Kings is so familiar in phraseology to the book of Deuteronomy. Now, okay, and all the people of the land went to the house of Baal. This is the male fertility god. Asherah would be the female. This is in particular male Baal Melquot, the Tyranian Baal. Tore it down, tore his altars down, his images they broke in pieces thoroughly. They killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars, several altars, and the priest appointed officers over the house of the Lord. What we have here is something very, very similar to Elijah on Mount Carmel, 1 Kings 19. As the north had drifted toward Baalism and God's prophet decisively broke the back of that, the same thing was happening in Judah through Athaliah, Jezebel's daughter, and through Jehoiada the high priest, the same decisive defeat, the killing of the prophets, the destroying of Baal's temple, occurred in Judah. So what we have is the same sins that are happening in the north. They may be happening a little later, but they're still happening in the south. Judah did not learn from God's judgment on the northern 10 tribes. Even the exile, she did not learn. Every sin they committed, she committed. It's a horrible, vicious cycle. Now, verse 19. And he took the captains of the hundreds and the Kerites and the guards and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down to the house of the Lord, and he came by way of the gate of the guards to the king's house, and he sat on the throne of the kings. Can't you just see that 7-year-old boy being escorted with the people shouting, "Long live the king," from God's house to the royal palace of David and Solomon, being sat on that throne that Solomon sat on, and all those people bowing down. Woo, that's quite a lot to handle for a 7-year-old boy. But he had an awful good trustee in Jehoiada the priest. Matter of fact, we learn a little later that Joash was a good king until Jehoiada dies. And you might want to see, I think it's chapter 12 describes all that he did. All right, let's see a little bit further here. So all the people of the Lord rejoiced, and the city was quiet. So they had put Athaliah to death with a sword at the king's house. And Jehoash. Now look at verse 21. You see the different spelling here from Joash? There's a J-E-H instead of a J. Well, now J-E-H is the covenant name for God. There is no J in Hebrew, so it's Yah, Yahweh. Now, J is a contraction of J-E-H. And so the spelling is really the same. But if you look at chapter 12, verse 1, it has that different spelling. So Joash and Jehoash are the same person, exactly. He was 7 years old when he became king. He reigned 40 years. And he was a pretty good king until the high priest died. And if you look over at 2 Chronicles, you'll see how far he went astray when the good high priest died and the princes led him back toward Baalism. It's a sad tale of great victory and promise and faith and covenant and great sin and rebellion and the same sins repeated over and over again.